Hello, and welcome to the Psychic Salon. I'm your host, Rose, and thank you so much for joining me today. Today, I have one of my dearest clients on as a guest. Her name is Luisa Echeverria. She has been coming to me for a few years now, and she's an incredible woman, an amazing storyteller. Luisa just recently retired with 30 years of experience in media, and she's currently on the board of several nonprofit organizations, including Alzheimer's Foundation of America, and based in New York, and Equal Hope, which is based in Chicago. You know, this past year, every time she would come in, it was like a little escape from reality because we would talk about all kinds of ideas or business ideas or just anything. So she always, I feel like, has a way of looking at things that's just a little bit unique and special. And she was recently telling me about the story she's going to share with you as well about a near-death experience she had as a very small child when she was living in Cuba, and really how it affected and changed her outlook on life. And it's incredible. I don't really want to go too much into it because she's about to tell you. So with that, I will see you at the end of the episode, and I hope you enjoy. Thank you. I'm so excited that you're doing this with me because you're so easy to talk to.
So excited to be doing it with you.
The whole purpose of this podcast is to talk about your psychic or otherworldly experience.
Okay.
So I see you every 3 weeks. You've become a good friend of mine.
A fixture. A fixture of the salon.
We talk about all kinds of things, and every time you always have these wonderful stories, but you had one that was like unbelievable about your childhood and when you were growing up.
Yep.
So, could you tell me about that? I know we talked about this a little bit, so I'll just kind of like let you get into it.
Yeah. I think that experience and what we were talking about was kind of like attitudes and, you know, how we feel about life and gratitude and all these things. And I think that experience really shaped me, really changed almost like the DNA of my brain or whatever, that I was able to grasp at that very, very early age without a sense of fear, just a sense of this is what it is, of life and death. So I was about, I think I told you, about 3 years old, and I was born and raised in Cuba, came over, you know, during the revolution, but at this time, so I'm, as you know, 68 years old. So I was 3 years old. So what, 65 years ago, the revolution was just starting. So things were a little bit chaotic, but life was pretty normal. But I wound up getting very sick. I had, I don't know if it was the measles or the mumps or both of them together. I'd been like a pretty healthy kid, but all of a sudden this thing combined, and I got super sick. I don't remember like the process of getting sick. I just remember being like super sick. And just, I'm an only child, and I was the first grandchild. So I was hypersensitive to adults, you know, adults being concerned about something, adults talking about something. My ears were always like, you know, pricked up for like, oh, what are they saying? What's happening? You know, should I be worried? You know, is, you know, or what's going on with the revolution? I mean, I know people think like, you were 3 years old, how could you be aware? But children are aware of what's happening around them. So I remember I was in bed, and, you know, everybody in the family was coming over. We lived a few hours from some of the different, you know, Cuba's not that big an island, so everybody was like an hour away, an hour and a half away. So all of a sudden, we would get together on weekends a lot, but during the week, it was unusual for people to come over, and I thought, okay, why is everybody coming in the room, and people are crying, and there's a doctor, and I'm like, what is going on? And I remember...
You were sick at this point. You knew you were sick, but you weren't aware of like why everybody was coming.
No. I just thought, you know, I'm really, really sick.
That kind of, okay.
But I didn't feel that awful. I thought, why is everybody reacting like this? You know, like everybody should just chill. What's going on? I overheard the doctor telling my father, I don't think we can save
her. Wow.
And I thought, about me? Like, save her, like me? And my dad getting upset, and he said, you know, this is terrible, but your wife is, we're going to have to do something for her because she is going to be in very bad shape, because I was very close to her. So,
and
I
you're
thought
the only
to myself,
child, yeah.
And I'm processing all this, and I always joke that, like, people say, like, oh, my inner child, I had an inner adult. Mm. I had, like, an adult in my brain always, like, listening, judging, thinking. I was very determined to, like, figure my way out in life. So I thought, okay, this does not sound good to me. But I at that point, I realized, like, I'm too sick to, like, even ask a lot of questions. So I'm just going to lay here. So I was laying there, and I remember, clear as day, like, having this sort of out of body, like, I was looking down, wow, definitely on myself. And I thought, and you are cute as a, like, your little hair is cute. And you've got this, like, cute, aww, little, oh, I had the cutest nightgown. And I thought, I really like that nightgown. And I've always been super aware of, like,
so
how do you look?
Sweet.
Like, does your hair look good today? Is your hair a big mess? So my hair looks cute, and the nightgown's super cute. And, oh, my God, there I am in the bed. And suddenly I realized, oh, God, why am I not down there? Oh, because I think I'm dying.
Oh, wow.
I am actually, they were talking about me dying, and here I am actually dying. And I remember this overwhelming anger, like, what, I can't swear, but like, what the actual F is happening here? Oh, no. I had, nope, put me back in that body. I mean, I was actually fighting with whatever force,
wow,
was like trying to take me.
You're like, wait a like, second, no, I didn't agree to this.
I did not agree to this. That 3-year-old put me back in that 3-year-old's body. She had plans. She wanted to live. She wants to live. Put me back in that body. And I don't remember after that. I don't remember the process of, like, jumping back in my body, being thrown back in my body. At that point, probably these people I was arguing with were like, oh, my God, she's a pain in the ass. We don't want her here anyhow. Get rid of her.
Okay, it's not your time. If you say
not
so, it's
her
not time.
Your time. Let her go. So I go back, and I don't know that process, but I remember waking up with a sense of bliss that I can't even describe. Like, oh, I'm back. This is,
wow,
great. And they made me juice, apple juice, but, you know, with the actual apple. So it was kind of like brown. It didn't look good, but it smelled good, and it tasted like heaven. I,
wow,
thought, this is the best tasting thing in the world. And suddenly I realized, I'm going to be fine. I'm back. And now I have to enjoy. It was almost like, in every cell, in every fiber of my being, I felt I now have almost like a responsibility to whatever created this miracle in my head, a,
mm-hmm,
miracle, because I'm back down there. I didn't know what a miracle was, but I thought, okay, I'm alive, and I'm going to make it a point, and I know this sounds crazy from a child's perspective, but I thought, I'm going to enjoy every minute of life.
How beautiful.
The good parts, the bad parts, whatever it is, it's going to be an adventure, and I'm going to enjoy it. And it sounds crazy, but, you know, a lot of Cubans in my age group who came through that Peter Pan program, they, you know, they were separated from their parents. They came here. My aunt and uncle sponsored me, and I wound up leaving Cuba. And my mom also had a very positive attitude in life, and she was like, hey, look, the revolution is, like, full blown. We got to get out of here. We're going to send you first. You're going to stay with your aunt.
How old were you at this point?
I was 9.
Okay.
I had just turned 9. So it was July 25th of 1961. I had turned 9 June 21st of 1961. So I was really pretty young. And my mom said, it's just going to be, you know, like our phrase was always, it's just going to be a big adventure. So you're going to get on the plane. They're going to give you Chiclets. And I thought, Chiclets? I hadn't had Chiclets in forever because of the revolution.
I'm going.
Like,
yeah.
Gum? I'm getting gum. I'm getting Chiclets on the plane. Get me on there. So, you know, I came over. There were really traumatic moments because, you know, that first night when I realized, okay, I'm here. I'm in another country. Nobody speaks English. At that point, I was actually staying with friends of my uncle's because my aunt and uncle were in Mexico. They hadn't gotten back to the United States yet to pick me up. So it was a little weird. I was a little scared. But even in moments of like fear or anguish or anger, I think there's this little part of my brain that's so grateful to be alive and to be experiencing every range of emotion. But I've also, and there's a part of my psyche, whatever, that can kind of step back from an emotion and look at it for what it is.
And be like the observer.
And be the observer and be aware. And then also in Cuba, a few years after this, I must have been maybe 5. Because I kind of remember stages depending on where we had lived. So it was before we moved to a bigger house. We were in this little house. My parents had gotten me a duck at a carnival. You know, we went to a carnival. I fell in love with this little duckling. And this duckling was like my bestie, like my best friend. It would follow me around the house.
It was a real duck.
It was a real
duck.
Not
like a stuffed duck.
No, it was like a little yellow duckling. Sweet. And I was crazy about it. And my mom, who had a really good sense of humor, named it Peking, Peking, like Peking duck. She had kind of a warped sense of humor. So Peking followed me around. My mom would let the duck, like, jump in the bathtub with me. So it would waddle around. Oh my God. I was like so in love with this duck.
What a fun friend to have.
Oh my God. It was wonderful. I don't know what we would have done had the duck actually lived long enough to grow into an actual duck. You know, this was still a duckling and maybe I'd had it, I don't know, a couple weeks. And, the door of the house, somebody rang the doorbell. I ran to the door. It was a really windy day. The duck was following me, as it always did, and the door flew open, and the duck died. It was, you know, I remember my parents crying. You know, I was crying hysterically. And yet I remember, like, sitting at the edge of the bed crying, and they were like, you know, your duck loved you and you loved your duck and that love will never go away. And I remember thinking, yeah, but it sucks. That was like my pet. I loved it. And again, at that very moment, I remember like sort of like pulling back and saying, oh, this is what loss feels like. Mm. So like, this is loss and it hurts a lot. But you get through it. You're going to just kind of like walk through this sense of loss. It's the only thing that you can do. Because you can sit here and, you know, cry for the next week. And then, you know, I've always hated crying. I'm not a crier. Because it would give me a headache, and you know, and then when I got older, like, your eyes are bloodshot and you don't look cute. So, you know,
avoid it.
Like tears. No, I don't do ugly cries. I don't do pretty cries. I try not to cry, you know, God willing, you know, but I remember at that moment, like, okay, this is what loss feels like. This is, you know, so that all these different emotions, come with, I know it sounds so crazy, but with a sense of gratitude because you're able to have had, you know, that sense of loving this little animal so early in your life. And you lost it, but you know, I always feel, you know, Jim always gets me like these little ducks and, you know, and I'll keep them like that's a reminder of, you know, of love and joy and gratitude. I think that that's the best way to explain it. But there have been many times in my life where I have felt like that sense of, I don't know if you'd call it like the surreal, like something, a sense of having had a past life, or of evolving.
Well, that's what's interesting too, because, and I'm curious, like, did you get to tell your parents how you felt? Like, because for them, I'm sure that was traumatic and terrible. I'm sure they were grateful out of it, but for you, so young to have that.
Yeah.
And then clearly you stayed aware your whole life.
Yeah.
So this carried into
probably
everything you did.
And I was very lucky because I had my parents for a very, very long time. I mean, I was, you know, as a matter of fact, this Friday will be 10 years that my mom passed. Oh. So I had her until I was in my late 50s. Mm-hmm. That's a really nice long time. You know, the last few years, as you know, she had Alzheimer's and that was difficult. But even through that, we found ways to communicate and ways to make the best of everything. And my dad, you know, I lost in 2014, so I had him for a long time. And my parents and I talked about everything. So I probably didn't articulate, you know, my joy of like being alive when I was three, or my understanding what loss was when I was about five. But as adults, we would talk about these things. Mm. And we would also talk about, although, you know, my whole family was raised Catholic and all that, but still, we would talk about past lives and what, you know, my dad was like, I think I've lived other lives. And my mom definitely said she thought she'd lived other lives. And I feel like very certain that I lived
other lives. Do you ever get glimpses of what those lives might be? Okay, so tell me about that.
I think I might have told you once about my Tokyo, my Japanese thing.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
That I'd had. And I would sometimes have like these I think they're called precognitive dreams where you see a place or whatever that you've never been to before. Like it's in another, you know. And then all of a sudden you go there and you think, oh my God, I had a dream about this exact place.
So bizarre. Yeah.
You know. And that happened to me in Tokyo. I wound up going to Tokyo when I was 25 years old. I actually turned 26 in Tokyo on a total fluke. I worked for a company, an organization, the woman who was the head of my division who was supposed to go, wound up getting this great job and had to quit. I had an active passport. They said, can you go to Tokyo? I was like, sure. I hate flying. You know that I'm a fearful flyer. I hate getting on planes.
So that's a big flight for you.
That was a long flight, but I'm going to go, I'm going to do my job, I'm going to do the best I can. But I didn't even know I was going to Tokyo when I had the dream, as I remember it clearly. Like, I think I had like a month's notice to know that I was going to Tokyo. So maybe 3 months before I found out I was going to Tokyo, I had this dream. It was very vivid, and I call them bliss dreams. Like, you don't know what triggers them, but suddenly you're in this dream where you're like completely, it's a happiness that goes beyond happiness.
Yes.
That's like,
I do know what you're talking about.
Right?
Sometimes I wish I could like summon those when I want to.
Yes.
And then I just can't.
No, like, you can't.
But see, okay, maybe you should teach me because, well, I think I went through a period where I was having a lot of stress dreams of like, which also are interesting, but I won't get into that right now necessarily. But I think in those times when I was so desperate for it, I couldn't because I was in that like emotional state. But now that I'm more calm, it's funny because it's like they are just more random or whatever. But I still long for some of those. Like,
you long for them.
I feel like for me, it seems more random. So, after your story, you're going to have to share with me how you make that happen.
Well, I can't. That's the whole point. I wish I could make it happen.
Oh, I thought you said you could. I was like, no.
I wish I knew how to summon it. They just happen randomly. Desire for that sense of bliss is what draws us to love. Falling in love can give you that sense of bliss, like at certain, it's probably that oxytocin or whatever that chemical is in your brain.
Serotonin or
whatever. So there are moments when I have it in waking, in waking moments, you know, sometimes after a martini, there's a little bliss, you know, being with my husband or having a conversation like this. Oh, you feel very blissful. But this is something that is totally random in your dream. I don't, you know, if I've had like 10 of these dreams in my life, that's probably a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, it's not like every year I have two or three. No, this was very, very specific. And I looked through a gate and I saw this beautiful, what was obvious to me, looked kind of like a Japanese garden. Some statues, the types of shrubs and foliage and flowers. I thought, this seems kind of like Japan. I mean, there was talk of Japan in the organization that I worked in, but no talk of like, you're going to Japan. Mm-hmm. It was just totally random. But I remember like looking at that scene and feeling a sense of bliss that really cannot be described with in any language that I speak.
Wow.
You know, it was just another, it was exactly that. It was otherworldly. So I go to Tokyo and was there to work. I was in this, at a convention, and I think we had like 2 days off. I went to, and I am like the world's biggest chicken when it comes to like getting on public transportation and going somewhere. But I felt compelled. And, you know, some people were talking like, oh, there's this temple, a Shinto temple outside of Tokyo. You can get there on this red line. All you have to do is just get on the train that, you know, has the red symbol and you follow it to the end of the line. And it was the Temple of Asakusa. I'll never forget. Mm-hmm. And I somehow, by the grace of God, because I am not that I'm adventurous, but like public transportation and stuff like that scares me. And I get to, I get on the train and I get off at this temple and I walk through and there to the side, I see the gates. I look through the gates and there's the garden.
Wow.
In exactly, the, you know, and this was like, I'd had the dream like probably 3 months before I found out I was going to Tokyo. So we're talking about a dream that was maybe 4 or 5 months old. So it was still pretty vivid. And I thought, oh my God, this is that garden.
Did your jaw just drop?
My jaw dropped. I wasn't with any family member or anything. And, you know, this was Tokyo in, what, 1970 something. So it wasn't like I was going to be calling home to say, you'll never guess what. You know, so I just kind of kept it to myself. But I've often told that story. And I feel an incredible affinity and understanding of Japanese culture, and it makes me very happy. There's this television station called NHK, and they do a lot of programming from Japan and different regions of Japan. And every single time I watch one of those programs, I do get this sense of like wonder and awe and connection with that culture.
Wow.
You know, so there's something to it.
Obviously, yeah.
You know, there's something to it. I don't know, you know, I don't know when it happened. I don't know how many lives I lived, you know, in that country or in that culture. But something beyond just an admiration of the culture draws me to it.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like, it's a familiarity.
It's a, yeah.
There's something there that's just like, that you can't put your finger on.
I can't put my finger on it.
Because you know the difference. There is a difference when you're just like obsessed or like something or admire somebody else's whatever, you know? But when you have like that kind of a feeling, it's an unexplainable kind of feeling.
Or people you meet suddenly you're like, oh my God, I can talk about anything in the world with that person.
Yes.
And, you know, an acceptance of your experience, I guess that's what I would say.
Yeah. I love that. That for me is something is like, because I always feel like, I know this sounds funny, maybe it doesn't sound funny, but I always felt like from a young age, there was something in me that was like, oh, I want to connect with people on a soul level.
Yes.
So you can cut through all this stuff.
Yes.
We always put on a thing. And I felt like that was something I was able to do.
Yes.
And so it was fun when you were able to, because it's like, oh yeah, I recognize you immediately and I can be myself.
Yes.
You know, like, I mean, you know, you're always a version of yourself, but there's like, you're working at different levels.
Exactly. Exactly.
So I love that feeling. And for places or things.
Yeah. Totally. And, you know, and I think that talking, like as you're calling it, you know, on that soul level, helps relieve a lot of the anxiety of living in the world we live in today, whether you want to call it, you know, in the COVID world or, you know, in the age of technology when, you know, there are so many glitches and you get, you know, bogged down with all this stuff. To be able to find somebody that you can talk to on that level, I think is really, it really is good for everything. I mean, it's good for your health. It's good for your psyche. So, you know, I would have, you know, if this ever winds up being listened to by anybody, that people find, you know, there are people, and you'd be surprised, you know, and sometimes it can be somebody you're sitting next to, you know, at the library or whatever, and you walk outside and you talk about a book or something, but finding ways to connect with people on a level that is non-judgmental and accepting. And accepting on a level that has nothing to do with appearance or social status or the things we have. I think we need to get back to those places.
I agree with you. And I think it's funny because when you're talking about this, this is something I've been sitting with, especially after this past year.
Yes.
Because I always felt like, oh, I can connect with people. But this last year, I felt like that was really hard, obvious, for obvious reasons.
Yes.
But there's so many things happening. And you do feel a loss.
You do.
I think that was like what was interesting, because when I would get sad, it's like, okay, there's a lot of reasons to be sad. But like, what is, why is this random feeling of like, oh, and then it took me a while. It's like, oh, it's a longing to have connection.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, like I was longing to have something that I didn't, I think I took for granted a little bit before.
Yes.
You know?
I think we all did.
Yeah.
I think we all did. And now we're finding it. And so I think this is kind of like peeling away layers. So, you know, maybe this pandemic is good for people being able to reconnect when we come out of it on a much deeper level. And again, on a level of gratitude for that experience that we have all shared in different ways.
And going back to like your original story of when you were a child and you got sick.
Yeah.
And how that set the stage of being able to be an observer, because you experienced something like so traumatic.
Yeah.
Then it gave you this kind of idea of what it could be like another option, where that's where I think it's funny, like this past year, right? It held up a mirror for a lot of us because it took out distractions in our life. And I will say this, this past year has been a completely different experience for a lot of people.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Like, I'm not trying to generalize that some people, you know, have been in terrible things, and that's a whole different situation. But I think to notice it, like, how do you appreciate something that you it is just so common, you can't realize when it's not gone until have this time. So I think like what you're saying, it has allowed me to be grateful for things that I don't think I was necessarily
really
totally aware of.
No, exactly.
So through contrast.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, I think we're gonna find, you know, it's almost like when we unearth ourselves, you know, when all these layers get peeled back, we're going to find truer, more genuine selves who connect on truer, more genuine levels.
Definitely.
I think,
beautiful.
Well, thank you.
Well, Lisa, oh my gosh.
This is so much fun.
I feel like you need to be my co-host at some point. We're into our own podcast. No. You're so fun to talk to. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I know people are going to love listening to this because you just have such a wonderful disposition in life. And I think like it's refreshing to hear somebody that's like, oh yeah, we can look at things a little bit differently. So thank you for sharing.
We all learn from one another.
Yes.
Awesome.
All right.
Thank you.
All right, you're welcome.
I hope you guys enjoyed that as much as I did. Luisa's incredible. Thank you so much, Luisa, for sharing your story with us. After this, if you guys would like to continue the conversation, you can go to my Instagram page, which is The Psychic Salon. Pretty easy. And we can continue to talk about this. Do you have a story of a past life or a near-death experience that you'd like to share? Please send me messages or send me your stories. I'd love to hear them. And I'm sure everyone that listens to this would also. All right. Until then, you guys, I hope you enjoy your day, enjoy your life. And I will see you again soon. Bye.